This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, supported in part by DailyProgress.com. Check out the latest in area entertainment on the Lifestyle section at DailyProgress.com. A unique class at the University of Virginia has spent much of the last semester analyzing where Charlottesville residents get their food. Students in an urban design course on community food systems reported this week that most of it comes from a long way away. They offered a few suggestions on how to make it easier for consumers to purchase locally grown meat and produce. The final class presentation of Plaque 569 was held on Monday, May 8th in City Council Chambers. Before the event began, I spoke with Ella Kambernbeck, a second-year student in the course.
It's a class made up of graduate and undergraduate students representing pretty much all majors in the School of Architecture. So we have architecture students, landscape architecture students, planning students, both graduate and undergraduate. And we've spent the semester evaluating and analyzing our local food system. So basically we've looked at where food in Charlottesville is coming from, both what's being produced in our area by local farms, dairies, meat slaughterhouses, and then whether that food is getting to people within the local area or whether it's going elsewhere, and why. And then also as far as what food's being consumed here, where's that coming from, and if it's not locally produced, why not?
Some might ask, why is this a matter for an urban design course? Kambernbeck explains.
In order to have a sustainable community, you have to support the people around you. So by buying food that's produced in Mexico or California or Brazil, we're not supporting our immediate farmers and people that we're intricately connected to.
If you think about how many people eat in our region, you'll get some sense of how daunting a task the class faced.
The work of finding the data was a lot harder than we thought. Finding the farms and contacting food distributors was very challenging. So I think what we ended up with was basically raw data, and who we invited to hear this presentation is a combination of local farmers, local business owners, local restaurant owners, local chefs, city council members. So all people that are tied into this potential food system. So I think what our hopes are is in presenting this data and information, we can stimulate conversation and start a dialogue among everybody. One thing that we noticed when we were gathering the information was that there's a rift in the connection between the production and the distribution of food. Local farmers that are producing the food don't have a relationship with local grocers or local restaurant owners. So potential connections that could support the system are lacking. So our hopes are that in these beginning stages, we can start forging these relationships and begin the process of creating a better food system in our area.
Tim Beatley is one of the two instructors in the course. He says the urban design department's interest is connected with the School of Architecture's interest in sustainability.
Food and food production touch so many different aspects of sustainability, from energy consumption, conservation protection of agricultural land, public health. All of these things come together around food, and so it's just a natural extension, I think, of the sustainability things that we were already interested in. So it's the first time that we've done it, and the students actually, you'll see this in their presentation, have focused primarily on taking stock, kind of looking at how food is produced, who's producing it, looking at some of the obstacles and impediments to a more sustainable community food system. And so they will offer a few ideas about opportunities.
Beatley says food that has to travel thousands of miles to a person's dinner table may be cheaper for the consumer, but it comes with cost to the society as a whole. He says the system as it currently exists may not be sustainable.
We've become profoundly disconnected from food and where food is produced, how it's produced. We buy something in a large grocery store and we don't have much information about that food. We're lucky if we know what country it comes from. And the statistics suggest that food is traveling ever farther, 1,500 miles on average from where it's grown to where it's eaten.
Welcome to the Plaque 569 presentation. It's our community food systems class.
The public presentation began with this basic question asked by the course's other instructor, Tanya Denkler-Cobb.
How many of you create food for yourselves or others that you sell?
City Council chambers was about two-thirds full, more than the attendance at some council meetings. Local farmers, grocers, and food activists were there to hear the presentation, to begin the dialogue that the class is designed to foster. And here we present an edited version of the final presentation of Plaque 569, Community Food Systems.
My name is Blake Bowen. I'd like to start as we often do in this community, and I'd like to defer to the wisdom of Thomas Jefferson. In a 1785 letter to Abigail Adams, Jefferson commented on the immense importance of food to society's well-being. And he wrote, "I fancy it must be the quantity of animal food eaten by the English which renders their character insusceptible of civilization. I suspect it is in their kitchens and not in their churches that the Reformation must be worked." Now, while I do not necessarily endorse or share Jefferson's anti-English rhetoric, I do believe that a lot of what he's saying is relevant to us even today. Truthfully, a large part of society's well-being comes courtesy of what we eat, and we Americans are currently struggling. When so much of our population is suffering from rising incidences of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease, it makes perfect sense that our next major revolution should not be fought over in Iraq, but maybe we should make it happen closer to home within our own kitchens. Within 5 miles of this room, maybe even less, you can glimpse one of the most agriculturally productive regions on the entire East Coast. And while so much is being offered at so close a range, we are more likely to make a trip to the myriad food offerings and grocery stores on Route 29 North than visit a local farmer who might be right outside the city's borders. This profoundly globalized conception of food change is indeed problematic, and it makes perfect sense this way that 17% of our current vegetable consumption comes to us courtesy of potato chips and French fries. To us, such tendencies seem irrational, and over the course of last semester, our class, Plaque 569, Planning for a Sustainable and Secure Food System, has struggled to make sense of them. With the guidance of our professors Tim Beatley and Tanya Dink-Lacob, we have endeavored to create a comprehensive report on the state of our regional food system, looking at its various components, its strengths, as well as its weaknesses. Analyzing and reporting our findings, we hope to affect the future of our region, and we hope to affect it in the manner of its health, its environment, and its economy. And ultimately, what we hope to create is a local and sustainable model that serves everyone within the city's borders.
Any food system consists of four parts: the producers, the processors, the distributors, and the consumers. Melanie Barnum gives a brief overview of area producers.
Our region has a wide variety of produce and animals being raised here. Our survey was limited by who we could find, so we had a little over 30 farms that we got to interview. Most of them had a lot of diversification within their own farm. Several were just produce, but within produce they have flowers and vegetables and plants that they grew, beekeepers. We had everything from the traditional meat to emu, several turkey, chicken, geese that was produced for meat. Most of the produce farmers were smaller, the meat production was larger. There was one farm who transferred into making a specialty sorbet.
As the presentation focused on smaller producers, Elaine Quick reported on the financial concerns facing many family farms.
So across the counties, farmers' typical income is low. Being the base of the food system and our local food economy, this has to change, because low farmer incomes push farmers to sell their lands to developers and also act as disincentives for young people to become farmers. There are ways to make farming more valuable and attractive. We could change the current regulations to make small farmers more attractive. Farmers reported pressure from the government to comply with regulations that were often for industrial scale farming and required fines that were scaled to enormous financial operations, not the kind of farming that supports a local food system. Another barrier that farmers face, a problem rather, is the land value. We heard often about troubling relationships between farmers and developers. The tax increases caused by residential developments, coupled with the difficulty of saving for retirement on low incomes, means that many farms are sold to development every year. These developed acres will likely never be farmland again, but with changes in public perception, farmland could again be given a higher value to be left in farming rather than developed. On the screen, you see a view of the western edge of Charlottesville. Here we've highlighted the Ivy Creek Natural Area and the Ragged Mountain Reservoir with its accompanying natural area. People who live in the greater Charlottesville region cite the natural beauty and rural countryside as draws to the area and aspects that they would like to see preserved, even as the county population continues to grow. A coordinated effort to give preference to family farms in this area can include the creation, through easements and hedgerows, of corridors of protected space linking one natural area to the other, thereby preserving the habitat and genetic diversity. Placing farmlands almost inside the urban area also benefits farmers, as their ability to respond to high-value niche markets and the growing everyday market increases. According to MetroFarm.com, the highest profit per acre farmland in the United States right now consists of small farms inside the urban rings. Creating an agriculture-preferred zone here would curb development pressures and serve as an example of what sort of creativity can emerge when a single solution challenges itself to address multiple problems.
Renovating the distribution system is the key to shrinking food miles, according to Lynn Nesselrode. Here's her description of the area's food network.
Nationally, Americans spend 10% or more of their income on food. Annual consumer spending reports is monitored by a number of governmental and non-governmental agencies. Earlier, we mentioned that 400,000 people are living in our food region. If half of those 400,000 people spent half of their weekly food budget for half of the year on locally grown food, this would translate to $300 million spent on our local economy. But it gets better. When you buy something from a large corporation, though some of that money stays here, the majority of it goes to the hometown of the corporation to pay for office staff and executives. Right now, an apple grown in Crozet would have to be moved from the orchard to a shipping hub somewhere in Georgia, Chicago, or elsewhere, and then be traveled again to Charlottesville. The question that we wanted to know is, how is that money being shipped, and how can we alter this situation? So, when you buy something locally, though some of that money will leak out to taxes, the idea is that most of that money will stay here and then be circulated again and again by continuing to encourage local practices. Suppose local merchants eat at local markets, visit local doctors, ride local buses, pay local accountants. The conventional estimates state that a dollar can be spent 3 to 7 times within our local food economy. So that $300 million being spent 3 to 7 times calculates out to, for those of you without a calculator, $900 million to $2.1 billion within our local food economy. That makes farmers seem a little bit more valuable now, doesn't it? So what's missing now is the link of how. How to get the apple from Crozet rather than going to Georgia or Maryland to Charlottesville. Within our research, we also, on the distribution side, interviewed local restaurants and groceries. So when asking groceries and restaurants from whom they get most of their food, the names Sysco, Aramark, Standard, and Cavalier couldn't help but come up over and over again. These two larger companies, Sysco and Aramark, provide services to hospitals, schools, elderly homes, and institutions of various sorts. They provide everything from 10 gallons of pickles to 400 forks and plates. From the hamburger you eat at Jabberwocky to the filet mignon down at Blue Light Grill. The larger conglomerates are everywhere. Looking at the total sales from 2005, both companies were approaching billion upon billions of dollars in sales. Even local distributors, such as Cavalier or Standard, though they try to purchase from local vendors, cannot always guarantee such things. So additionally, three of the major Sysco distribution plants are within the state of Virginia. One in Harrisonburg is within the map we showed you earlier of the 50-mile radius, and one in Front Royal is just outside. Our attempt with our study is to encourage instead to support local sustainable practices of linkages between a distributor and a producer. Anthony Flacavento is involved in the Appalachian Sustainable Development Nonprofit Corporation. It's just to the south of us, and it's a cooperative of farmers linked together with methods of shipping to groceries and restaurants.
Through this method, the necessity of these large conglomerates becomes lessened, and the ease of incorporating local food becomes increased.
But where do people buy their food? Sarah Thurman outlines the Charlottesville grocery scene and talks about the accessibility for low-income families.
Groceries were defined by our group as those stores offering a range of fresh and packaged goods where shoppers are able or likely to get at least 80% of their groceries. Small groceries were those which also had a range of fresh and packaged goods, but in more limited quantities, where people were more likely to do 50%, nowhere more than 80 at the absolute max. The other stores, such as the convenience and corner stores, those have limited variety and more of like the packaged goods, chips, sodas, that type of thing. As can be seen from the map, there's a strong concentration of what we termed grocery stores along the Route 29 corridor. 6 of the 13 groceries identified are on this Route 29 corridor, so almost half. There are a couple more in the Pantops area to the east, 2 more in the central city region, and 2 in the southern portion, south of downtown. All of the big chain groceries that we were able to interview use regional warehouses. All food going to a store must first be sent through one of these warehouses, regardless of where the farm that grew that food is in relation to the store where their goods will ultimately end up. All the stores were not allowed to make individual decisions on a store-by-store basis, with Whole Foods being the exception, and that occasionally managers are allowed to decide on their own if they want to buy from some individual person without it having to go through a warehouse first. Pricing of goods varied greatly between the stores. Our team conducted a price survey for a number of stores in the area based on a set basket of fruits and vegetables. What we found was that surrounding demographics were not necessarily related to the prices in the store. For example, Integral Yoga had some high prices on a lot of the fresh fruits and vegetables, and yet low median incomes in the surrounding area. This uneven pricing in the city relates to the idea of food justice, a topic we explored through the use of Census 2000 data on income, race, and vehicle availability. When examining the distribution of incomes relative to grocery location, those areas with lower median incomes also tend to have fewer stores nearby. Of particular interest is the area south and southwest of the downtown mall, which also shows up as having high proportions of persons in poverty and high proportions of persons using public assistance. In addition, these low-income areas also tend to have large minority populations, meaning that access differs among ethnic lines as well as socioeconomic. The area surrounding the rotunda also shows up as very low, but that's mainly students, so we don't have to feel too bad for them. The biggest store in the southern region, the IGA Foodliner, was found to have fresh produce of somewhat lesser quality and also lesser quantities than available in other comparably sized stores. The other main store in the southern area, Seville Market, while having a large variety of fresh fruits and vegetables, doesn't necessarily have a wide selection of some other dietary staples like breads and cereals. Those same southern areas also have low rates of vehicle ownership by household. Thus, in such areas, the ability to get to a grocery, and thus food, in the current food system, is hampered by both lack of nearby facilities and the lack of means to get to other further away stores. While there are some other areas of the city with moderately low levels of both income and vehicle availability, such as those along the Route 29 corridor, they tend to cluster around existing groceries, so issues of food equity and food access are not so important, or not as relevant there. Many convenience stores, gas stations, and small shops are scattered throughout these low vehicle and low income areas. But with having little to no fresh produce available and prices generally higher, at least from national data, than the bigger stores, they're not really a good substitute. Public transit serves as an alternate for those without a car. Technically, all groceries except Whole Foods are directly serviced by at least one bus route. Looking at the southern portion of the city again, we can see that only Route 6 goes directly to the groceries that have both a wide selection of items and relatively affordable prices. Using other bus lines would require at least one transfer. The downtown mall is the major hub for buses, which is, so that's right near that area. With all routes in this in the question, making a loop there, facilitating movement to other parts of the city with somewhat ease. The frequency of buses are different between the routes, though, some only running once an hour or so. In addition, hours of service may be limited, many not running past 6 or 7 p.m., making after-work shopping more difficult. After talking about points of purchased food, it must also be noted that there are significant points of non-purchased food as well. The Blue Ridge Area Food Bank Network serves 25 cities and 9 counties, which works out to be approximately 1.2 million people. Nearly one-eighth, or 150,000 of those people, live at or below the poverty line. 129,000 of those people, around 10%, received food from this network last year alone. This number, if you break it down, works out to 16,400 people being fed in any given week. Last year, the food bank distributed 8.5 million pounds of food to those people in need. Food distribution from the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank Network is comprised of 22% from the USDA, though this number is decreasing on a yearly basis. 53% comes from the food industry, and less than 3% comes from volunteer farms, surplus farm goods, food gleaning programs, or plant a row for the hungry. The remaining 22% comes from food drives and donations, which are typically more prominent during the holiday season and then curtail the rest of the year. The possibility of introducing more local, fresh food into the system can promote a connection within the community. Furthermore, as noted, the times when the food bank is at its highest need are the times when the growing season is at its highest production level. 1 + 1 = 2.
And now, Lynn Nesselrod lays out some of the group's suggestions.
So what are the opportunities? We don't want to leave you with a doomsday. The opportunity to create a network between the producers and the consumers must be noted. Albemarle County has recently tentatively approved the creation of an agricultural planning position. Additionally, Susan McCray, the general manager of Integral Yoga, expressed a desire to have a comprehensive list of production opportunities partnered with distribution needs. By means of such a list, the connection between local producers and local distribution points can be solidified. Other possible outlets for locally produced food could be community gardens. Located on plots in the urban landscape, these outlets would promote close access and community connection. Finally, a market cooperative, essentially a Charlottesville-only Whole Foods, which could be the potential to make a market with an increase in access and information to local food systems and what they're about.
Let's give the final word in this podcast to Blake Bowen.
As we close today, I'd like to again quote a notable thinker, this time not Jefferson, perhaps someone who's maybe a little more liberal and a little more philosophical, and that would be Walt Whitman. Whitman once said, "Now I see the secret of the making of the best persons. It is to grow in the open air and to eat and sleep with the earth." Extending this ideology to our region's farms, we find that we can most wholly create a food system that is both local and sustainable in its orientation. Thank you.
But that wasn't the end of the presentation. After a brief question and answer period, the farmers, grocers, and food activists in the crowd mingled, exchanged cards, and began planning for a follow-up meeting to occur in June. To get involved yourself, or if you have questions, send us an email at info@sevillepodcast.com. And we'll make sure it gets forwarded on to the right people. That was info@sevillepodcast.com. We'd also like to know what food choices you make. What do you think about this idea of buying food locally? Please leave a comment on our blog at sevillepodcast.com. The Charlottesville Podcasting Network is a public service of Wordcast Productions. I'm Sean Tubbs. Thanks for listening.